Welcome to the Aphorists. My name is Jesse Holding. This is episode 2. I'm sitting here with my co-host, Anthony Ryan.
Hello.
Hello. So we're talking about The Master. You just saw it. I haven't seen it. In fact, I have no plans to see it.
Because two people told you not to see it.
Because two people whose opinions I respect told me not to see it. The premises actually doesn't sound all that interesting to me. And I listened to the review in the Culture Gab Fest. Was it last week when they were talking about it?
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't actually make it sound very appealing either, despite the rave reviews about parts of it. It just didn't sound very interesting to me. But you enjoyed it. What do you think?
I did, and I don't understand dissuading someone from seeing this movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they weren't dissuading me. They just told me that they did not enjoy it. Mm-hmm. So I figured, I don't.
Didn't you say they told you not to see it? No.
No.
You just said they hated it.
Like, my mom got up about 3/4 of the way through and said she had to just get. She was feeling. It was making her feel too claustrophobic and not in a way that she thought was enjoyable. Like, oh, I'm experiencing this emotion, and that's what the point of this movie is.
Mm.
She just was like, I have to get up and walk. She got up and walked around the lobby for a little bit, and then went back in and finished watching it.
Mm-hmm.
She was saying like all the interior shots had no windows. That there was like this real, and that there was a sort of a level of aggression that didn't. You know, the relationship between the two, Joaquin Phoenix and what's his name?
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
He says, I want to take you on a slow boat to China. And says mm-hmm. she says she thought it was in such a malevolent way that the whatever, or such an aggressive and malevolent way that whatever supposed intimacy. That sort of ruined the feelings of whatever like affection there might be, and that there was a sort of aggressive or malevolent underpinning to that, which I don't know, sort of I guess ruined it for. I don't know if it ruined it for her, but it left her feeling like that she didn't that at some level there wasn't she didn't enjoy it, I guess, and not in the way that like I don't think. Her requirements for enjoying something aren't, that it's lighthearted or something like that. She doesn't go to rom-coms, you know what I mean? She likes a good...
Yeah, I understand the distinction.
Yeah.
Like, she can deal with an art film. Right. Which, that is an art film.
Yeah, it's an art film. So, I think it left her a little bit cold.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was surprised by how into, the Culture Gab Fest people were in it, although by it. But I guess now that I think about that, they really loved Magic Mike, which I just thought was an atrocity.
Oh, I don't think they universally.
They
loved that.
I don't think they universally loved it, but they definitely liked it more than it. I feel like it deserved to be liked. I think Dana Stevens is the film critic. She had some problems with it. I think Stephen Metcalf was, I don't know, it's funny the things that he loves or doesn't, or hates, like things that I think that are fairly either unlikable or just boring. He's sort of like head over heels about it. And then, he wants to put that documentary about the couple that's building, Versailles, in the biggest house in Florida. He was like, he wanted their heads on pikes. Which seems like an awfully strong reaction. So.
Oh, well, he's into hyperbole.
Yeah, right.
So are you interested in Scientology?
Yeah. I mean, I guess, topic. It is. I find it, I think it's fascinating. I think it's fascinating. I think, I remember reading the piece in the New Yorker that was at, I have no memory of when it came out, but it was written by a guy who had left Scientology and it was either an interview with him or written by him, and I think that same guy had something to do with the script of The Master, although I could be wrong about that. But he just sort of explained.
Paul Haggis, you mean?
Yeah,
the guy who wrote the big or was right. interviewed in the big New Yorker piece.
Yeah, yeah. And so
he may have consulted. I don't know.
Yeah, I sort of recall his name being associated with this film, but I could be just making that up. And so I thought it was fascinating. You know, I think it's I guess I am interested in it. I'm interested in the way that they attempt to silence any criticism of the religion in the popular media.
Did you read that New Yorker piece?
I did.
We'll post a link to this.
Oh, yeah.
If people haven't read, they had a very long form New Yorker piece, and I can't remember the author's name.
Right.
But it basically chronicles the screenwriter Paul Haggis's experience with Scientology.
Yeah.
And he's an interesting case because he's not somebody who came to Hollywood and adopted Scientology. Like he was from Canada originally, and as a very young man, he got into Scientology.
Yeah.
But he broke with them over their opposition to same-sex marriage.
Right.
That was his specific
That was objection. His breaking point, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he sort of details a lot of the internal, he details the entire structure, but he also talks about a lot of the real negative, and probably illegal practices that...
Yeah, that basically exposes a lot of human rights abuses.
Right.
That are perpetrated against members.
Yeah. I find it a fascinating phenomena in as much as I find any religion a fascinating phenomena. And actually it's interesting cause I'm reading, I don't know if you saw the piece in the September 17th issue of the New Yorker where Salman Rushdie, it's sort of basically an excerpt of Salman Rushdie's,
I haven't read it, but I've seen some interviews.
Autobiography and, it's really well written and interesting. Although he writes it in a very basically writes it in the third person about himself, which has a funny. So he's revealing these really deep interior feelings about him, meaning me. You know that he's writing. He's not saying I felt this way. He's saying he felt this way when X happened. So he's sort of like an omniscient narrator. Talking about somebody else, but really he's talking about himself. So it's just an interesting conceit in terms of writing. I just found that after a long time of waiting that Satanic Verses is now on audible.com, unabridged. And
does he read it?
No, he doesn't read it. Another guy reads it, and whose name I can't remember, but
it's a great narrator.
Yeah, I don't know if he would or not. It's curious because this guy does voices and, each character has a different voice and, he does accents and I don't know if those are offensive or not, but it's good. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it has to do with the beginnings of Islam and so how a religion starts out. He's fictionalizing how a religion starts out. Mm-hmm. And gives Muhammad this, he's having visions of an angel, this character, Jibril, who is a character, just like a person like me or you, who turns out to be, who sort of against his will maybe, or, and I'm not finished with the book, so I don't know the sort of origin story, but you meet this character, and then it turns out he's an angel, and then it turns out he's has this relationship with three or four people in the book so far, through dreams where they dream him, the angel, and then make him say things essentially. So, the process is Muhammad has these desires or has these things that he wants and he projects them onto the angel Jibril in the dream. And Jibril he's impotent to act in the dream, right? So he doesn't understand how he's channeling this thing. You get to hear his interior feelings and Muhammad's interior feelings. And he does it with there's several other religious epiphanies or visits that he has with other characters, and it's all the same thing where he's either a passive, he's always a passive character even though he's in the dream. So he's sort of like a power that enables them to do what they want to do. Which I find, and I'm probably not explaining it very well, but it's a sort of a fascinating conceit or idea. And so I can understand why, and Jibril is actually on an airplane flying you know, the real guy, or the quote-unquote real guy, is flying in an airplane, falls asleep, has these dreams of an ancient time, right? So it transcends time and space. And so to say that the angel that gave, that came to Muhammad was actually a man flying to London on an airplane at that moment would be upsetting, I guess.
Is that the blasphemous?
I think that among others. I mean, yeah, there's plenty of ups. If I were a Muslim, there'd be plenty of things that would upset me in that book. Mm-hmm. But you know, I would also, I assume, take it as the piece of fiction that it is. And so I don't know how. So it's interesting. Like, so the reason I'm talking about it in terms of Scientology is that Scientology is incredibly intolerant of idea, you know, of criticism or or people speaking out against them, and they want to control the narrative. I remember in the early days of the internet, when people were posting about Scientology, my uncle lost many, many hours of productive coding to what he referred to as the soap opera of Scientology on the message boards and on various websites, because people would post things about their experience as Scientologists or opinions on Scientology in general, and then they'd get hit with the ISP would get hit with a cease and desist order by the Scientologist lawyers. They were just throwing money at this, you know, this is just at the beginning of the, you know, right when like the internet was not as ubiquitous as it is now.
They were right there.
They were right there, and they were trying to control the narrative.
I wonder, too, if there was a nexus between, like, early adopters and, like, Scientology people.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, meaning, well, I guess in some ways, right, because, like, the entertainment industry was picked up the internet quickly, right? And that was one of the first places that, or one of the first industries to start taking advantage to leverage the new medium, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they did it not in the way that it's done now in terms of providing content. I think that they were, it's advertising and getting the word out and all that stuff. But anyway.
Well, I thought the movie was great.
Was it? Right on.
Yeah. And, it was a difficult movie.
Did you see it in 70mm?
I don't know if I did or not.
Where'd
I don't
you see
think
it?
I did.
The Kabuki?
Embarcadero?
Embarcadero. Probably not.
Yeah. But, yeah, I think that, it sounds like your mom had a physical reaction to that movie, almost.
Yeah, she definitely did.
Yeah, so.
I mean, that's a powerful thing, you know, I think that's.
But very individual.
Too. Right, right. And then my friend Josh saw it. I mean, he just sent me a message saying, because he and I had seen Moonrise Kingdom. We were debating between Moonrise Kingdom, The Master, and Arbitrage, the new Richard Gere film. And
we ended up movie film.
I hate to call something like that a film. I don't know. I would call The Master a film, and maybe Arbitrage a movie. Or maybe that's a ridiculous distinction. But we ended up going to see Moonrise Kingdom, which we both loved. And, he sent me a message saying that he and his wife had seen The Master, and we made a really good call, and it ruined his night, basically.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I saw it with my friend Todd and his wife Connie, and, Todd and I have been kind of messaging conversation about it since then. Anyway, I don't want to talk about it too much if you haven't seen it, but
yeah.
I thought it was interesting, like, I was wondering the other day if, now who is the artist? I can't remember his name. He's a video artist. He started out as a video game designer, and then he was a pretty successful, like, video artist. He would do these large-scale projections. Most famously, this one he did about the Winchester Mystery House.
Oh, Jeremy Blake.
Jeremy Blake. So, Jeremy Blake and his wife, like, there was that whole drama, I think it was, like, in 2007, where they both committed suicide.
Right.
And they sort of, like, started running this crowd in Hollywood, and like there were these stories of them getting really paranoid about like Scientologists sort of like gunning for them or something.
Hmm.
You remember this?
I don't. I mean, I remember their suicides, but
yeah, yeah.
I don't remember. So, I had no. I didn't really know what the lead up was.
Yeah, it'd be good to maybe revisit that.
See yeah. what's going on.
But I was like wondering because Jeremy Blake did. He's worked on like some opening credits for other Paul Thomas Anderson movies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the one I know about is Punch Drunk Love. Like he did,
right.
He did the opening credits, and so I was wondering if like that experience was part of what prompted Paul Thomas Anderson to take on the subject.
Yeah,
but it's interesting in that it's like not—it's not an exposé of Scientology in any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think for legal reasons, he's had to like claim right. that it's not even Scientology at all.
Right.
But like. The main thing, there was a theme in it that was very poignant to me, which was like sort of, first of all, the Joaquin Phoenix performance is just remarkable. His physical performance,
mm-hmm.
and like his physical transformation for that role is so amazing. And I really loved it. Like, I just loved his role. He was completely riveting. You could not take your eyes off him
wow.
when he was on screen. And Paul or Philip Seymour Hoffman like gives it also an amazing performance, but it's kind of more low key, ironically, since he's supposed to be like the more charismatic of the two.
Mm-hmm.
But like, so they have this father son relationship. I mean, that's,
right.
Or you know whatever they have a great complicated relationship, sort of an understanding, and but. Like, I felt like what was really powerful about that character was how he sort of was a stand-in for, you know, we kind of look at that post-war period as sort of idyllic in some ways
mm-hmm.
in the United States, like, at least for, like, you know, white Americans, like, living in this very affluent society and people, you know, people sort of, whatever, like, you know, indulging in, like, this new sort of consumer lifestyle, but like I think, and this is not new territory, but there was a lot of malaise. Like there was definitely a lot of like sort of psychic malaise in that mm-hmm. period, and you do see the rise of all these, you know, kind of self-actualizing philosophies,
mm-hmm.
you know, which are kind of always there in the American psyche,
right?
You know, like it's really not that new.
But, you think it just becomes more pronounced after World War II, or?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
And I like the character of the Joaquin Phoenix's character, sort of, to me, is like this stand-in for just sort of this damaged, you know, culture, you know, people damaged by war, sort of psychically ravaged by war.
Mm-hmm.
And for this character, it's sort of physically, you know, sort of, he physically embodies that.
Right.
And one thing that was also really compelling from that, in that for me was his character really reminded me of someone I grew up with, a cousin of mine who is older and since passed away. But yeah, my cousin Jackie McGraw was this guy who was like, he had a disability. It wasn't clear. I was like, it was always vague. Like he had epilepsy and like he was one of these characters who kind of always lived with his mother
mm-hmm.
His whole adult life and always in really poor health, sort of inarticulate, just like horrible teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of almost as a child, you know, you almost perceived him as like a monster in a way.
Right.
And like this character is kind of like that. But even to like his sort of these high-waisted, like, 50s clothes and, like,
mm-hmm.
this way he held himself where he would, like, you know, hold his arms. Like, he would sort of, like, make a fist and, like, cock his arm, resting his arm, like, on his kidneys or just mm-hmm. above his kidneys, always the character would.
Right.
Very stooped.
Huh.
Like, there was all this body language that was so reminiscent for me of this relative of mine.
Wow.
So I felt like he tapped into this sort of pre-television sort of person
mm-hmm.
that we don't experience anymore, like someone who's so completely unpolished.
Right.
I guess maybe you do experience it, but we're getting more and more in an era where people are so sort of self-possessed and self-aware, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. like, you know, even ordinary people can like handle themselves on camera.
Right.
You know, and this character is just like so arcane in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he was able to like draw that character is really amazing.
Right.
I don't know, there was just some interesting little things. Do you know the painter John Curran, right?
Yeah.
There was this one scene, pivotal scene, and here I am spoiling the movie. But, because I really resisted like any like reviews or trailers or anything before I saw it, because I wanted to see it fresh. But there's this amazing scene where Philip Seymour Hoffman is like, it's meant to illustrate like his sort of charisma where he's singing this folk song. While a woman plays piano and at the home of one of their wealthy benefactors, and like there are all these women, and I think the scene is also meant to demonstrate like his sort of power over women.
Mm-hmm.
And we're, you know, in this, you know, this speaks to like what sort of an art film this movie is. At some point in the scene, like suddenly all the women are naked,
mm-hmm.
and you know, they have like, you know, these bodies that are, you know, just not Hollywood bodies,
mm-hmm.
But it's just the women are
right.
naked in the scene, and it's kind of a fascinating scene. But like between the era and like that sort of aesthetic of women's bodies, like it was, it felt like this like sort of John Curran painting of
right.
life, you know, like the way in which he like he sort of he always emphasizes, you know, sort of female attributes, this
mm-hmm.
point of being grotesque,
right.
Kind of had this aspect, that aspect to it.
Huh, interesting.
But, yeah, the movie is not, it's not a neat movie. It doesn't,
right.
doesn't lend itself easily to understanding, but pretty unique vision. I don't know. I honor it.
You know, right on.
And I want to see it again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. Definitely.
Well, maybe I'll consider going with you.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Except you're going to hate it afterwards, so I'll be around you.
You think so?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't really know what you look for in a movie.
Yeah, I don't either.
Like, what movies do you like?
I mean, like, I really
Ghostbusters?
Like... Don't cross the
beams.
We can agree on that.
Yeah.
I mean, I really liked Moonrise Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see that?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you enjoy it?
I did. I had some problems with it, but overall, I really wanted to like it so much,
right.
I gave it a lot of slack.
Right. I mean, I guess one of the things that I really loved about it was the fact that it, you know, it was in some ways a totally predictable movie.
Mm-hmm.
It followed a traditional arc where, you know, you sort of know what's going to happen, but it was told in such a non-traditional way that I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
For that. Right, so you sort of know, like, I wasn't worried at all about it having a happy ending, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And what that might mean, you know, not every character is going to be unscathed or whatever a happy ending might mean.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was, you know, strange enough, and that the, you know, I just found it strange and like quirky in the. In a good way, not in a sort of what's become as this, you know, a trope of the quirky girl or whatever that show is. Chloe Deschanel, is that her name? You know,
no, but I
yeah,
like
you know
who I'm calling her that.
Right,
the manic pixie dream girl.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I mean, that's like a trope, and it, you know, Saturday Night Live skewers it really well.
Mm-hmm.
Her and you know they have like a really funny. Bit with that's you know featuring not her as the you know someone playing her obviously
although
and,
when she was
and when
on,
she was
on
it they did it too
and she played
she
like
great.
One of the Ashley twins
yeah yeah so I mean it was good she has a good sense of humor obviously
mm-hmm.
Brian Williams has this hilarious rant against Siri the commercial that Chloe Deschanel Brian Williams a newscaster
yeah
has this hilarious rant again about Siri and the Chloe Deschanel commercial where she's like, Siri, is it raining? You know, and clearly she's standing in her house and it's raining. You know, she can see
oh,
out the
right,
window
right,
that it's
right.
raining. And anyway, sends Brian Williams into fits of apoplectic rage.
What's he got to be mad about?
Yeah.
So I think just on Moonrise Kingdom, like, I think my problem with that movie was, like, just a couple of the performances were flat. Like, Bruce Willis was, like, had he ever seen a
Wes Anderson
movie?
Yeah, you know, I didn't, I felt like...
he is such a phoned in actor, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think in that, I'm not a huge Bruce Willis fan, so I'm not, like, defending him necessarily. But I think in this case, I think his, he just seems, like, reticent at some level all the time.
Yeah.
And so that there is this sort of emotional uninvolvement or disengagement
that worked for
that character.
So my other complaint about that movie was I was so excited that Bill Murray and Frances McDormand were going to be husband and wife in that movie, and she was totally wasted. Like, she got no important screen time, and that was the other bummer.
Do you think he got? I mean, I think that both of them kind of were.
Bill Murray was amazing. He didn't. Of course, you always want to see more Bill Murray, but he kind of like he did very well with the time that he had.
Right,
he knows how to do that, and. And I also thought Scout Troopmaster, Ed Norton was also fantastic.
Yeah, he was great. Yeah, no, I mean, I hear what you're saying. I mean, it wasn't perfect, but I really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the kids were interestingly complicated, and that there was just a lot of. I mean, I laughed out loud a lot in that movie. I just thought it really was just absurd in a lot of ways that just I thought was really compelling and great. So I could have watched it again. And I thought the music was really good in it, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I really liked that aspect of it.
Cool. Do you want to move on to another topic?
Sure. Picking up from a thread, we were talking about cars and bikes. And so Adam Rogers, who I guess writes for Wired, did a piece on an observation deck where talking about a plan for London to build, or a proposal that's happening in London to make elevated bike lanes that connect buildings or connect transit hubs.
Mm-hmm.
And he's making a case. He didn't think that was going to work, that there's just no way that would ever get funded, which... I probably tend to agree, but he was making a case that, and he talks about a couple cities that are being built or have been built that are basically make it impossible for cars. You know, they intentionally prohibit cars from the city. From the cities, you can drive to this space, but once you get into the space, you can't drive. You can ride your bike. You can walk. You can take the internal transit, but there's no cars. And that, you know, just he was basically questioning the primacy of cars in a city space. And that definitely picks up where we were talking about, you know, downtown San Francisco, Market Street, just the tension that's there. He starts off talking about how when he and his wife go for a walk in their neighborhood, she walks diagonally from corner to corner, like to cross the street. And that makes him, you know, he said, you know, he grew up in the city and he said, you know, that would just be, you know, you just can't do that. Like
she walks through the intersection. She walks
through the intersection diagonally. And he's like, no, that's not fair to cars. Essentially, you know, it makes him cringe. Mm-hmm. And it made him realize that like, well, what do you mean fair to cars? You know, like why should cars be given the primacy? Maybe pedestrians should be given the primacy or bikes should be given the primacy.
And there are a couple of intersections in San Francisco that are kind of designed for a diagonal.
Right. They do. A lot of downtown intersections stop all four directions.
Center and Montgomery.
Yeah.
And 4th and Folsom.
Right. There's a couple.
Times where there's red for all traffic.
Right. And then, red for all traffic. And then everyone can
see more of that.
Yeah, no, it's great because I think it definitely, I'm all for that. Amanda was telling me about an interaction she had driving home, leaving downtown, trying to take the right on from Market onto New Montgomery or Second or whatever it is there, and you know, a pedestrian. She's about to make the turn. There's a gap. Pedestrians have stopped. It's like the countdown is basically zero, and this pedestrian just runs in front of her car, and so she has to slam on her brakes. And he glared at her and pointed at the light, like pointed at the walk light. And she's like, "Yeah, zero." You know, they are seeing the same thing, but it means different things for them, right? To him, it means I still have a second to get across the street, and to her, it's like, "You should have."
Rule.
Yeah, it's a real rule, though. But I agree that it does, you know, there, I definitely see the point of the primacy of the, you know, it's organized for the primacy of cars and, whatever. But I just thought it was funny that you could, two people could see the same thing and it can mean different things to them. To a pedestrian, it means I still have 1 second to get across the street. I'm legit. And to drivers, it means, you know, you're really supposed to not get into the intersection at that point. So, but I do like the idea that you could, I mean, if a city was really well organized, that once you drove, like you could drive to the outskirts of it and then get on either get on a bike or whatever, or walk, or however well it is organized, that, that exchange is fluid and well designed, that would be great, because you have this high density area, that gets confounded by cars in a lot of ways. You know, there's a big push in New York to add more taxis, because people have to wait during peak hours. People have to wait for, you know, 25 minutes for a taxi, essentially. But so people think, you know, let's just add more capacity. But the problem is that it doesn't work that way. If you add more cabs, it actually slows down travel time because there's too many cars on the road.
So, well, plus the cab drivers will fight that.
Cab drivers are fighting that, and they're fighting it for, you know, for their own, for their, you know, to protect their economic interests. But also, it is, you know, there's data to show that what they should basically do is they should cut down the number of taxis, and that will actually increase the efficiency of the exchange. There's a Planet Money podcast about it that we'll put a link up on the page that does a deep dive into that. But it's pretty fascinating that you know, there is a critical capacity for vehicles in a city, and adding more roads doesn't necessarily, you know, adding more lanes doesn't change things, because
people have known that for a while,
right? And then adding more cabs doesn't fix the lack of cabs. So I think that's pretty fascinating. It's really counterintuitive, right? You can't get a cab, just add more cabs. But if you add more cabs, you'll be able to get into a cab. There'll be more empty cabs, but the trips will take longer.
Plus, those cabs will be idle during the off-peak times.
Exactly. So, and it's interesting to see car services like Lyft and Uber. I don't know if it's Uber Cab, but Uber, which is an on-demand.
Yes, I was. I was just looking for that.
For Lyft or for Uber?
I can't remember which one it is. It must be Uber.
Lyft is the one with the pink mustaches, and Uber is the one that does basically...
Oh, you're on top of all this.
Oh, yeah.
How is it you're on top of all this?
I think about this stuff all the time. So...
So talk about Lyft for a moment, because it's an interesting model.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. So basically, it's an on-demand... both Uber and Lyft are app driven. So you register on your phone. I think there's Android and iPhone.
We'll put a link up.
We'll put a link up to both of those. You specify your location. You know, it's all based on GPS location tracking. And for Uber, it's basically a delivery service. You know, it's the Lincoln Town Cars, but, you know, with the TCP on the bumper. It's not a cab with a medallion. And you don't exchange any money with the driver. Same thing with Lyft. But the driver sets the price, or the Uber application sets the price based on demand. So in peak time, so like when bars let out, for example, at 1 a.m. or whatever that time is, it's past my bedtime. I have no idea what time bars let out, but whenever they do let out, then everyone 2 a.m. So at 2:15, everyone's trying to summon a car.
Mm-hmm.
The price goes up according to demand. And same thing at rush hour, et cetera. So the market basically dictates how much a ride costs you, which I think is a very interesting model.
Actually, they're saying Lyft and is then saying, Lyft is, I'm on their website saying mm-hmm. it's a suggested donation.
Exactly. So then Lyft, you set your own price. So it basically works the same way. You summon a car, you and then you go, that person takes you wherever. It's their private car. They've registered it. And then, you know, you say, okay, that ride's worth $15. Here's $15. And you don't exchange money with the driver. You do it through the application.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm starting to see a lot of pink mustaches driving around San Francisco.
Yeah.
Which is, it always makes me, I want to make a joke about getting mustache rides, but that's terrible.
That's what they should call it.
Yeah. Mustache rides. Totally. That's great. So I know, I think it's very interesting. I mean, then there's other services where you can, you know, you use, what is it that you use?
City Car Share.
So there's other things where, like, so I could, and I don't remember the site, and I'll look it up and put it up on the site, on our site, but, you know, you can basically rent out your car in the same way. I could turn my car into a private City Car Share, and it's the same thing. It runs in the same way. You register with a site, but instead of private cars, instead of public, quote unquote, public cars, I mean, the City Car Shares are private cars because they're owned by the corporation, mm-hmm. City Car Share.
Yeah, yeah.
But I could add my car to a pool and, you know, people could check it out during the times that I'm not using it.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, it may not get used very often, but it would supplement to some degree my insurance and gas and the cost of my car.
Mm-hmm.
And then it doesn't, it's one less car on the road, right?
Yeah.
So I think that those kinds of sharing, and there's actually some interesting statistics out now that the millennials, that generation, are not buying cars anymore. They're not buying houses and they're not buying cars. They're sharing, they're using sharing services and renting.
Mm.
And so as the baby boom generation retires, our generation, the X generation,
we're just going to use all their stuff.
We're going to use all their stuff, right? And then the next generation is going to not going to consume in the same way that we consumed, that we are consuming, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting. So, but it has ramifications for the auto industry, the American auto industry, for better or for worse. So I think as EV cars come online more, although there's some discussion about that, but and then congestion pricing and all that stuff happens. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the cities.
So can I use this topic to segue into one of my pet peeves?
Yeah, for sure.
This design firm in San Francisco called Stamen Design, again, we'll put a link up, has researched and published this infographic, essentially, which is a map. It looks like a typical transit map, actually, and it depicts the network of private, basically private transit services that are operated to shuttle San Francisco residents to Silicon Valley.
Mm.
And so this group, Stamen, like, they have things like they've mapped the world's friendships on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Visualizing data, basically, is what they're about.
Right, right.
So, like, this particular map shows all of the routes connecting, as I said, San Francisco to Silicon Valley. Let me look at the legend here. And it's sort of like, you know, uses the graphics to show, you know, which one is the highest volume.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, reading this map, Google is the highest volume. They have some routes, and you can see where they go. They start, like, in the Marina District.
Mm-hmm.
They go down Van Ness. They go through, basically, there's one that goes then through, like, Mission Bay and down. Everything's heading to either 101 or 280 to bring people down the peninsula. There's another one that services the avenues and then hits the Mission District and then heads out. The second one would probably be Apple.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, just looking at the graphics here, I would say maybe the third one would be Facebook, but it would be roughly comparable to Yahoo and eBay.
Right.
Okay, and I don't see Genentech on here, but I know Genentech. Genentech was probably the pioneer with this. I feel like
But this is just Silicon Valley. They don't, because I see like USF and Art Academy and a couple other.
They've only listed Apple, eBay, Electronic Arts.
Mm-hmm.
What's Electronic Arts?
They make video games.
Okay. See, I'm so out of the video game loop. Facebook, Google, and Yahoo.
Right on.
So
they talk about like how many there's so much repeat. Like once the graphic is interesting because once it hits the highway, they all go the same place, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so this is a pet peeve of mine because I live in the Mission District, and it really gets on my last nerve that these vehicles use basically the public infrastructure mm-hmm. in order to shuttle
people out. Yeah,
yeah, people out, and. In my, I guess I would sum up my objection to it, my principled objection to it, to the idea that, God damn it, the way the social contract works is that these corporations should pay in to augment and to improve transit for the entire population.
Mm-hmm.
And thereby sort of like, you know, these companies that are very affluent will, like, help the society as a whole. And they're helping, you know, people that are riding Muni are using all their products, you know. It's like,
right.
So there are some maybe overblown, like, you know, claims of, like, elitism and sort of class division and mm-hmm. criticisms of these of these transit systems,
which I don't find particularly compelling.
Well, I'm a little ambivalent about those claims. Although it's undeniable that when you see a very fancy, brand new bus with huge bike racks on the back, very comfortable reclined seating, Wi-Fi, mm-hmm. you know, the whole schmigeggy, like pull up to a Muni stop,
mm-hmm.
and discharge all these people that are in their 20s,
mm-hmm.
you know, to go and like live their urban experience,
mm-hmm.
Or go to Silicon Valley to right. work in their suburban corporate campus.
Right.
And then you contrast that with like the next bus that shows up, which will be like the 48 bus, which right. is full of people who do not have the benefit of having these affluent corporations
mm-hmm.
to employ them, people that are going to work at, you know, restaurants or mm-hmm. doing childcare or whatever. We're talking about like
mm-hmm.
immigrants, people on fixed incomes, people on public assistance, disability, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, right.
Like these are the people that suffer sort of the indignity, I would say, of having to navigate a very unreliable transit mm-hmm. system.
Right.
That, you know, doesn't go everywhere, mm-hmm. You know, oftentimes doesn't show up.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, depending on your income, it can be quite expensive.
You right. know,
these yeah, employees for, sure. for mm-hmm. Google and so forth are not paying
right.
for this service.
Right.
In fact, it's bigly zero. I would say it zeroes out their commuting budget.
Right.
Although they probably own cars, too.
Yeah, it's curious. I mean, I think from a how many cars on the road standpoint, it's good, right? If they didn't, like, if the Muni system and the Caltrain and all that being what it is,
mm-hmm.
not improved, those people would probably drive from San Francisco to their jobs. So
yeah.
this is a net gain by having them take this fancy car. You're right. Now, I guess your argument is if Google, et cetera, invested money in San Francisco's public transit infrastructure
to no, make if it, they were compelled by law to do so.
Right, but then why would they, you know, people, yeah, I mean, it's curious. It's like the, I've heard arguments that the San Francisco payroll tax makes it so that corporations don't want to set up shop in San Francisco because it's more expensive for them to do it there than outside of San Francisco.
Why big box stores set up in Emeryville.
Right.
That's why they set up, because San Francisco is a city that has to maintain a public infrastructure in order to function.
Right.
Now, these companies all benefit from that public infrastructure.
Absolutely. Right, right.
Because their customers and their employees use this public infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
But they would prefer not to pay for that.
Right.
So they relocate in counties with very little public infrastructure, so they don't have to pay those taxes.
Right.
And that is wrong.
Agreed.
That's just wrong.
Yeah.
You know, the city of Oakland with this huge tax liability sits there right across the border in Emeryville. Every big box store imaginable, IKEA, Home Depot, et cetera, have all set up. Why? Because Emeryville has no public infrastructure to speak of, so they don't charge any taxes.
Yep.
So the residents of Oakland go and pay sales tax in Emeryville.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm sure Emeryville has probably really nice police cars.
Hey, you think Emeryville will be nicer than it is?
Well, it was a rail yard.
It was. I mean, it's
about. Yeah. So it's just stuff like that. It's just the same mentality that puts, Mitt Romney's money in the Cayman Islands, Switzerland.
Right.
You know, it's like, anyway, here's my rant.
Nice rant.
Yeah. But I think, it's a libertarian's paradise, right? There's no mass public transit.
Mm-hmm.
There's only private public transit.
Right. Private transit that uses public resources, right?
Right. It's
like Elizabeth Warren had that really great.
Private mass transit is the term that I've settled on.
Right, right. Elizabeth Warren makes a good point about that in her stump speeches. She's running for office and she's running for Senate in Massachusetts and talks a lot about the corporate use of public infrastructure,
mm-hmm.
and that it's not fair, basically, that they pocket
want wage earners to pay for the infrastructure that makes their business possible.
Exactly.
This is the point that Barack Obama was trying to make with "You didn't build that,"
right?
Which, of course, is such a, his point being that the government has a role to play,
right?
To enable business to function,
mm-hmm.
but these ignoramuses at the Republican convention took that as this rallying cry,
right?
First by taking them completely out of context,
right.
and twisting the whole concept and missing the point,
yeah.
To use it as the slogan for their goddamn convention,
right?
It's ignorance as a point of pride,
right?
Like, I don't think about things, and that makes me better than you.
Right.
It's like this reverse elitism.
Yeah.
Like, if you actually are thoughtful.
There's something wrong with you.
Yeah, yeah, you're weak. That's a weakness.
We go by our gut feeling around here. Thanks very much.
Go by my gut.
I go by my gut. My gut's telling me that corporations shouldn't have to pay for roads.
Mm-hmm.
That's the government. Hold on. No. It's not the government's job. Whose job is it?
Paper roads.
Yeah.
Well, a libertarian would say you just make people pay to use private roads.
Oh, corporations should take that. We should privatize the roads, and then everyone should pay a toll or pay into it.
Yeah.
Huh. Very bizarre outlook.
Oh, well, I have this quote that has never caught on that I've posted on Twitter and so forth, which is libertarianism is Silicon. Okay, libertarianism is to Silicon Valley what Scientology is to Hollywood. And by that I mean it's this dirty little secret, and it's that it functions according to this totally magical thinking, debunked ethos philosophy that is basically accepted as conventional wisdom in these different milieus, if Scientology is that sort of self-actualization through just complete self-confidence, then and in Silicon Valley, it's like, I don't owe anyone anything. I've earned all this.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I guess it'd be interesting to know how much giving goes on in Silicon Valley.
Charitable giving?
Charitable giving. Yeah, I don't know the numbers.
I don't either, but I feel like it's historically lower than other businesses.
Yeah, I don't know. Just
conjecture. No, I just reflect on, like, you know.
I mean, there is a sort of, like, bootstrappy mentality there, for sure, right? So that ignores, you know, winning the lottery of how and when you're, like, the parents you're born to and where you're born and IQ, all the things that lead someone to being an intelligent person that can do that kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it's, I don't know, maybe rampant's not, maybe rampant's too strong a word. I don't know. I don't have a lot of interaction with those kinds of people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more necessarily how they're portrayed in the media. I mean, I read a lot of what's, you know, the technology blogs, and technology writers seem very thoughtful. I think Kevin Kelly is an example of someone who's deeply entrenched in that. He's an editor for Wired magazine. Anyway, so, you know, and him and Chris Anderson are, I think, both very thoughtful people, deeply interested in improving the lives of everyone. And I think, you know, if they're the sort of poster children of Silicon Valley, then I think they're, you know, that's a good... It's a place. It's not an unalloyed good, but there's a lot of good, thoughtful people there. You know, and you can say what you want about, you know, Mark Zuckerberg or Facebook, but it has done a lot of. I mean, the technology. What technology wants? That's what Kevin Kelly wrote. Mm. What technology wants?
Yeah, he's not who I'm thinking of.
Yeah, fascinating read. I recommend it. But you know, it's like say what you want about. Social media, whatever. I mean, it's done a lot of, there's a lot of good things that come from it. And so, but I don't think, obviously, it was created out of some deeply humanistic impulse, but other than the one to interact and share, which I think is sort of universal. Mm-hmm. So, but we're getting away from our original topic, which is, or maybe it's.
I was hoping you'd argue.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Planet Money just did this thing. So here I'm going to take maybe an argument, but so Planet Money did this thing where they got six.
I listened to this.
You listened to it. So the six economists that got together and created a platform.
No income tax.
No income tax. No corporate taxes.
Only consumption tax.
And legalized marijuana. There was a couple others. Or legalize certain drugs.
Can we say on the taxation thing?
Yeah, for sure.
Convince me that a consumption tax is not a purely regressive tax.
Oh, I'm not going to convince you of that.
No?
No. I don't, you know, I haven't, to be honest, I haven't really, as much as I've read about economics, I don't have strong opinions about the right way to structure taxes. Mm-hmm. I agree with that. The United States tax code needs a major overhaul. I don't have any ideological problems with setting certain caps so that people making $250,000 over pay more than people who make less than that. You know, I think I think getting rid of the argument for getting rid of the mortgage deduction makes sense to me. But again, I haven't done really any analysis of it to say whether something's regressive or progressive.
I just put my teeth in. Yeah. Because my voice sounds different. Less whistling.
Less whistling. I've gotten so used to your toothless voice, I didn't even notice.
Mm.
So I don't know. Yeah, I mean, a consumption tax isn't something that I can... defend or argue against necessarily. I've been that's not something that I find.
I guess you could argue that, like, since rich people buy more shit,
mm-hmm.
it would hit them harder as a work. I don't know
how
it works. So income tax was a result of the progressive era,
right?
Prior to that, there was no income tax, which is why people like Andrew Carnegie were able to just like amass like phenomenal wealth, unchecked wealth and power,
And I think, that the tax code makes it very easy for people to not pay what they should. You know, I think Warren Buffett is like the prime example of a guy who says, you know, I pay more the percentage than my secretary does.
What's his solution?
That, you know, you should pay, close the loopholes and pay a larger percentage of tax based on your your income. Yeah. I mean, I don't know that it's, I don't have the details of his solution, but basically he says if you make more than X, you should pay a higher percentage, period. So, and, you know, same thing with the mortgage deduction. You and I have mortgages, we deduct it, but the amount of money that that would be is pretty low compared to the folks that are in much, much higher income bracket. It benefits the rich way more. So, you know, it's talked about as like a killer for the middle class, but in fact, it's just thousands, I mean, quote unquote, just thousands of dollars in tax credits to the middle class, but it really ends up just reducing the coffers again on the backs of the middle class. So I'm all for that. But again, I'm taking all of this at the word of the various economists and writers that say that this is how it is.
So I interrupted you because they were basically building a presidential candidate, right?
Right. They were building a presidential candidate, an unelectable presidential candidate. They had a follow-up.
That wasn't their intention.
Well, no, that wasn't their intention, but they met with two. So they decided to come up with this platform that six economists could agree on, six economists across various you know, stripes. So Russ Anderson, my econ talk guy, who would be considered libertarian, who I thought sounded like just an obstructionist asshole in the discussion, ended up putting so I was very disappointed in him in his contribution to that discussion. But Russ then on Econ Talk last week published the entire hour where he was, you know, in the discussion that he had with his colleague, whose name I can't remember. We'll put a link up to this on the site, whose suggestion was that, the government should do this is now the time when money is so cheap and our infrastructure is so, underfunded that this is the time that we should be employing people to fix the highways. And he uses an example of a 10-mile stretch in Arizona that is in badly need of repair. If it were fixed now, it would be like, you know, $10 billion. But if we wait 5 years, it's going to be, you know, $67 billion. That the cost of repairing it, if we delay even a year, is, you know, substantially higher than if we do it now. And so he says we should get a group of people together, put them in a room, pick the projects that are going to give the most benefit, and get those funded and get them going. Now, he also talks about the I-95 corridor where trains can't, you know, that creates this big bottleneck where trains can't reach it, you know, go past, you know, 40 miles an hour or something like that. And so interstate traffic along the entire eastern seaboard and the train traffic, for transporting goods and people, as you know, he says it's not even first world; it's fourth world. Russ takes the point that so not anyway, what's that?
Not even third world.
Not even third world. He said, yeah. I mean, third world railway infrastructure is better than the eastern seaboard of the United States. You know, which is incredible.
Excella notwithstanding, that's the New York to DC.
Right. I don't know if there's a specific line that's okay. But basically, you know,
that's like the most popular.
Right. So, I mean, his point and then Russ, you know, he and Russ argue and both very, I think, intelligently and they're both very articulate. So I was very glad to hear the entire interview because it made Russ sound like less of a obstructionist and just a principled obstructionist. But, you know, my problem with the libertarian point of view is that they're basically saying, you know, don't do anything, essentially. But that's what it seems like it comes down to. You can't do anything, period. Everything's doomed to fail, and I just, you know, it just seems like really pessimistic at some level. I believe that the federal government can do a lot of good. I think that it gets, and they both agree, and I agree, that the political process is deeply flawed. But that doesn't mean it was always that way, and it doesn't mean it has to stay that way.
And libertarianism is a very simplistic, I would say, reductivist and appealing philosophy.
Yeah. Right, right. If the world were that simple, it would be great. It's just not. And I think, you know, one of the things that my buddy Russ says is that, you know, once an entitlement exists, it's very difficult to roll it back, to take it away. And I agree with that. So it is good to be, and so my caution there would be, we should be very thoughtful about the intended and unintended consequences of the actions that we take. That requires a sort of nuanced view. You know, one of the observations that Adam Davidson of Planet Money makes after the political campaign discussion that they have about the platform was that, you know, you'd think if you could get six economists to agree on something, six economists with very different viewpoints, if you could get them to agree on it, then it would be agreed upon by everybody.
That would be a consensus
position. A consensus position, right. But they consult with two marketing people, one guy that's done a lot of marketing for the you know, worked on Democratic presidential campaigns, and a woman who's done the work for Republicans, and they both basically agreed, like, you know, you just, none of these issues are votable issues. You know, people aren't capable or willing, maybe not capable isn't the right word, but aren't willing to engage in a sort of nuanced thinking that is required to make legislation that would be truly beneficial. And I guess the flip side of that, too, that's interesting is that, you know, you have what is perceived as an uncontroversial opinion, but can have all these unintended consequences that make matters, you know, that can make matters worse in the end, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we have limited knowledge about how the economy works. We think we know how it works, but, you know, in truth, it's models, and models don't work. And so, you know, gets problematic in that way. I don't remember how we got started on this discussion. Do you?
The Planet Money.
Right. But before that, why did we bring up Planet Money?
We're talking about taxation.
Oh, right. So
libertarianism.
Yeah. So anyway, I was glad that Russ was able to. Sound, you know, provided the backstory to his what I thought were unintelligent and obstructionist viewpoints in the Planet Money piece. So
you feel like he? Do you think he was taken out of context in the Planet Money piece?
No, I mean, I think his viewpoint is a little bit more nuanced than what I would consider a traditional libertarian view.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to hear his entire reasoning strain, which is not, his chain of reasoning is not uncomplicated.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a digestible, you know, it's not just a single sentence that you can make sense of his position.
Right.
So it requires some deeper thought, which is, I guess, the problem, right? That anybody's viewpoint, for the most part, requires some, you can't. Aphorisms don't carry the day. I mean, aphorisms carry the day in politics, right? It's short.
Well, some people, choose that to be their currency.
Right, but, you know, if it's complicated and nuanced, it's not going to get talked about, and most of this stuff is.
Mm-hmm.
So the tax structure is complicated and nuanced. You have to be able to sell. You have to be able to explain why. Just let's take the mortgage deduction. You know, there would be a riot if they decided to take the mortgage deduction off. But if they presented statistics about it, people who've got, you know, who have an interest in this would say, well, no, this statistic means this. And another person, it's like the Amanda's point about the pointing at the two people, both pointing at the crosswalk countdown sign, right? One person views it as you should stop walking because it's zero. And the other person looks at it and says, I still have 2 seconds to get across the street. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing about the mortgage deduction. Some people view it as their right, as, you know, that it's going to destroy the middle class if you take it away. Mm-hmm. And other people say, you know, you're looking at this all wrong. They, it's really protecting the rich. And so by insisting on this, you're protecting the rich. And it's a fundamental perception problem, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So don't know how who's going to carry the day on that. But, you know, it's what you would think of as an objective reality is really comes out to be a subjective idea about how things work.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that economists agree on something doesn't necessarily mean that average citizens who don't think about models of the way the system of the world works aren't going to be interested in having a discussion, or either interested or capable of having a discussion at that level.
So should we have these sort of elitist thinkers just sort of run the show, these enlightened people?
Well, isn't that what happened?
What do you call that? Technocrat.
Technocrat?
Well, I think we do, like, in the sense that the, the Fed is run by these sort of technocrats.
Mm-hmm.
People that are experts in their field.
Right, with a...
Of course, we immediately see the problem with that is that they have their own myopia because they're coming from... they're
right.
Oftentimes like Wall Street executives.
Right, right. They are captured for sure.
Yeah, yeah, and their yardstick for what constitutes, success and, growth mm-hmm. is what will benefit the industry that they're most familiar with.
Right. So what do you think about getting rid of their idea about getting rid of the corporate tax? Set the corporate tax to zero.
I was surprised to learn recently that the corporate tax here is higher than it is in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
But it's possible that in other countries, like in European developed countries, we're talking.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like there's more to that story. So that's a right-wing talking point that I've heard lately. But I feel like there's more to that story in that, maybe that's more airtight corporate tax and there are no loopholes or,
right.
Setting up your business in Maryland or
mm-hmm.
Delaware or wherever the hell they do it.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting how that would tie to the idea that corporations should help pay for the roads that they use, the public good, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how that structure works, but I mean, the economist's argument is essentially that you tax something that you want to limit. And so if you want to stop limiting corporations, then stop taxing them.
Mm-hmm.
Now how they like what controls their participation in the public sphere is then an open question. I'm not sure exactly how that works. Something I guess I can research. This is an interesting question. So if ostensibly corporate taxes go to the coffers of the federal government or the state government to help fund the infrastructure or all of the things that the government is committed to,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's local or federal. And so if that if essentially that money goes away, then how does the, how does that affect the funding of the public sphere?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm going to have to look that up. It's an interesting question.
Well, the common, the right-wing talking point is always if you lower corporate tax, somehow taxation de-incentivizes people making money, which seems ridiculous to me.
Why does it? Just out of curiosity. I mean, I can see both sides of that coin.
I don't know. Maybe I need to see some proof instead of people just expressing it as a truism.
Right.
Seems to me people still try to make money, and even though they have to pay taxes
right.
on their income.
Right.
They try to weasel out of paying taxes on their income.
Successful. Right. Yeah, I mean, the percentage of Americans who pay their taxes is incredibly high as compared to, Greece, for example. Right? I mean, one of the reasons Greece is in the shambles that it is that there's no culture of paying your part.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it's incredibly corrupt. It's so corruption is really high. Mm-hmm. Cheating on non-payment of taxes is incredibly high.
Shadow economies.
Yeah, so it just, it, that really, so it's like, there's no incentive They have a really high taxation rate, though, mm-hmm. across the board. So, or they did, or they tried to. And so, historically, it led to this thing where you're basically a sucker if you pay your share. And so, it just led to the destruction of their country. Whereas mm-hmm. America does not have that problem. I mean, yes, we can definitely talk about tax shelters and all that stuff. And I think
our tax laws have teeth.
Our tax laws have teeth, and most people pay. Mm-hmm. And now there's an equality issue.
Well, it helps if they take it out of your paycheck.
Right, right. Well, and then, so there's pay. Yeah, it makes it hard to cheat, but mm-hmm. The people are happy. You know, or whatever. I'm happy to pay my taxes. I see the good that it goes for. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the whole Romney 47% comment about the, you know, people who don't pay taxes. You know, it's they do pay taxes. They pay the payroll taxes.
Oh, or those,
you know, it's just like an idiotic position to take, and it's just hyperbole.
My brother-in-law had an interesting take on that, which is that like Romney thinks he's, he's got this whole CEO mentality. He thinks that his CEO mentality will carry the day and sort of save the country, and that's what he's selling us, right?
Right.
And like what you saw in that video is him. Doing what a CEO or a consultant would do. It's like you have your room full of investors and you're, mm-hmm. you know, you're convincing them that they've invested in a sure thing.
Right.
And like, that's very antithetical to a governing mentality.
Right.
Like he made it clear that that is his only constituency.
Right.
And he has no other constituency.
Right.
At least he laid it out on the line.
Yeah, and then I guess, I mean, and I am obviously no fan of his, but he was marketing. He was, mm-hmm. I mean, so it's hard to know if that's the true, if that's how he truly feels, or if he was just making it, like, being like he is with everybody, which is thinking that he knows what they want and trying to be that for them, mm-hmm. Which doesn't make him a good presidential candidate, but makes him, as an explanation for him as a human, mm-hmm. you know? So, I mean, that certainly, hopefully doesn't sound as a defense of him, because I find whatever his positions are fairly abhorrent now. Although it is curious about how he governed Massachusetts and did a lot of, like, you know, really good things according to the, that was the will of the Massachusetts people. Mm-hmm. So I think.
And he's running away from everything.
Right. National politics and the Tea Party have, you know, moved everything over into this crazy hyperbolic chamber.
Plus, he's a craven opportunist.
Right, exactly, exactly.
He has absolutely no principles.
Right, his compass is all over the place. It's just, it hits all 360 points.
Well, his true north is himself and his own ego. So
right, right. There you go.
Everything else will follow that.
Well said, exactly. Well said.
That's my high note. I don't think I'm going to get better than that.
No,
that's
good.
Say goodnight?
We should say goodnight. All right, this has been The Aphorists, and thank you for listening. Yeah.